Hi, quick notice at the top. This week we'll be publishing a special members episode that was inspired by the conversation you're about to hear. So listen until the end to hear what that episode will be about and how you can hear it. The 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee is a musical comedy with an unwieldy title that primarily features grown adults playing middle schoolers. It centers around a group of students with different backgrounds and family issues who are all trying to win the honor of competing in the next level of the spelling bee. As they try to spell difficult words, alongside real audience members who are brought on stage to compete in the bee, they reveal their hopes, fears, and dreams. Some spellers also experience some unfortunate aspects of puberty on stage, so this episode is mildly not safe for work. My guest today is Carrie Kearse, social media coordinator at Playbill. I hope you enjoy our conversation about the 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. Hello, how are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm excited. What are we talking about today?
You wonderfully are letting me talk about the 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee today. It's not often I get to like talk about this at length with someone because it's not one of the most, well, first of all, it's not still on Broadway and it hasn't been for quite some time. So it's like, it's wonderful to have someone else who's like very familiar with this show that kind of like had its heyday and went, it was kind of a dark horse even at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was, aside from the Tony nominations, but it was not like, does not have the staying power of like an Avenue Q or, you know, anything like that where people still immediately get the references.
Yeah, it didn't like become part of the zeitgeist or anything.
Tragically.
Tragically. I was going to say, I love how I'm letting you talk about something. Like I've invited you onto the show and you're like, oh my God, thank you. I need to talk about spelling bee.
I do.
Honestly, though, I feel like that's why this show exists, because people just love musicals so much and sometimes we don't get to talk about them, and that's what we're here for.
No, that's what and I work in like the theater industry, and like still like it doesn't present as many opportunities as one would hope to talk at length about spelling. I get more, fortunately, than I've ever had in my career before this, but still, like, you know, it's never, you can never have enough. This is a hill I will die on. Bring Spelling Bee back to Broadway.
It's time.
It is time.
Well, with that, what is your background with this show? Why do you love it so much?
So basically, I moved to New York very shortly after school. And I became aware of this group called the St. Bart's Players, which is the oldest off-Broadway theater in New York still running. They're on their like 92nd season or something now. And I was like, oh, okay, I want to be somewhat involved in theater again. It was like I had, you know, went to performing arts high school, but then I never really did any theater after that. But it was something that I still very much loved. You know, I always loved Broadway and theater. And, you know, I got to New York and about a year, I emailed them. I was like, hey, you know, my background was in video production. I was like, I'll make, you know, videos or take promo photos or anything for you if you let me come see your shows for free. A year goes by, almost a year to the day, I get an email being like, hey, we're working on a show called Spelling Bee. Sorry, we just like found this email. Would you like to come, you know, talk about it and do some like promo stuff for them? And so, you know, because the show has a very big improv component to it, we wound up doing these like video, like in character behind the bee, like getting to know the characters of Spelling Bee, and the actors were all fantastic and had like little bits and stuff that we did. And so in preparation for that, I listened to the album, and at first I'd heard of it before, and I was like, oh, this is like a kid show. It's like a Your Good Man Charlie Brown was just what I had kind of assumed, and that what I had assumed, and I was like, oh, okay, you know, it sounds like a fun, like family friendly show, you know, very like straightforward, feel good. And then as I start listening through the album the first time on like Spotify, I'm like, oh, this takes a lot of time. Cause like the music starts very like simple and campy with like the We Like Spelling, you know, and I get to Chip's Lament, My Unfortunate Erection. And I'm like, oh, okay. This took a turn in a way I wasn't expecting. And then you get to act two where you're getting into a lot of like more like the pathos of these like preteen characters and like, you know, a lot richer, darker, not like it doesn't get dark, but it does get quite poignant and quite sad. And I was like, oh my God, this was not what I was expecting at all. And then, you know, you get to the I Love You song, which is devastating. And I was like, wow, there's like a lot of richness to this that I like did not immediately know. And then when I saw like one of their final dress rehearsals and I saw all the like book material and the improv material in the middle, I was like, this is like a really, not to like spoil your lightning round questions at the end, but I'm like, this show is the love child of Avenue Q and You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown.
Yeah. Yeah, I can totally see that.
And I was like, I loved it. And I was just like, wow, this is something that really does the coming of age thing well, in the way that like Avenue Q does it for like a demographic that's like 10 years older. And I'm talking about Avenue Q so much. I saw it on Sunday for the first time and I was like, wow, this really is like post-grad spelling bee, you know what I mean? And it does the coming of age things with the ups and the downs and the funny parts and the shameful parts that deal with like aging and finding yourself, figuring out who you are. But it also, you know, is hopeful and optimistic and very funny and sentimental in a way that's not cheesy or shameful. You know what I mean? And it's a show, and I really, and it's one of my favorite shows because of that, you know, because it really is this very genuine show, but also very fun.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, there's so much I want to go into with all of that. First of all, I think the comparisons to Avenue Q are completely warranted because I think they both come from a very similar place of the comedy base.
Yeah.
Which I want to talk about more in a minute, but also first I just was thinking about how I feel like Spelling Bee would be super in vogue if it came out right now.
Yes.
Because I think there's so much middle school media happening right now.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the new age of like YA, you know, and like teen rom-coms. Think about like To All the Boys I've Loved Before and like all the, we had the wave of like Harry Potter's and Twilight and stuff, which I guess is a little more contemporaneous to like when the show came out in like 2004, 2005 area, like point in time. But it's like, yeah, we're now in like a very much like a YA sort of wave, and also a way, you know, that we're looking back on awkward teen years, like in a way that's not, it's not entirely shameful, but it's like not entirely nostalgic either. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, we were all embarrassing as kids.
I was thinking about the movie Eighth Grade, which I haven't actually seen, which I'm sad about. I really want to see it. And I understand it's a more serious take on it. But then there's also this brand new Hulu show that I also haven't seen yet called Pen 15, which is supposed to be like, it seems it's like a very similar kind of vibe to Spelling Bee. And then it's like adults playing middle schoolers and like this very sort of awkward adolescent state. And it's like, wow, this is the same lineage as Spelling Bee.
Absolutely. You know, and it's like stuff that's being written by people who are not quite so far removed from that time period, you know, as like people, like as millennials, I guess, are kind of like able to finally like get into positions of like where we're writing and producing content, like books, TV, whatever, like general media. We're able to look back with, I don't know, where it's like, we're not so far removed from it that it's like, you know, when you see a piece of media that's written by people in their like 40s and 50s and you're like, oh girl, you know, it's very awkward. It's like we've all seen, I don't want to like name any like media names, but we've all seen movies where we're like, who is this for or is this by? Because at no point would any of this go to, you know what I mean? Like the understanding of teen and preteen politics, you know what I mean, are not the same, or they're trying to project how things were in, you know, maybe in the 80s, 90s, back into, and like, and updated to now or to the early 2000s, and it doesn't quite work because our culture has changed and is continuing to change so much in terms of like, you know, the way in which things are understood, the nature of like difference is treated in terms of like race or queerness or, you know, different religion and stuff like that, or, you know, things that just, but also just like slang, you can tell when people use slang wrong. It's like, you don't know what you're talking about. But to your point, yeah, like this show, I think, ages fairly. There are like a couple points where it's like, oh, this is very much a product of the early 2000s in certain ways that don't hold up, but then much more of it does.
Yeah, before we dive too deep into its sort of legacy and its place along this lineage, I did want to take a return back to that idea of like its place in comedy.
Yeah.
Because So from my side, I was familiar with Spelling Bee, but I never sat down and like watched a production or listened to the soundtrack all the way straight through. And so I did that in preparation for this and also was reading about it on Wikipedia and everything. And what I really wasn't aware of is all of the improv aspects that are baked into it.
Yeah.
And the sort of aspects that come out in the live production that you don't hear in the songs. And I mean, so I'm 22 and I live in Chicago, which means that I know so many improv comedians and people who work in comedy.
Oh my God, I bet you do.
and so it's just like just reading about Spelling Bee just sounded familiar to me in this way of like this really clever comedy base that was so clearly made not by, it was so clearly came not from like musical theater people who are beautiful and I love them, but like it's just clearly like a different culture that this was made by comedy people.
Yeah. Like reading through like the show's history as well, like also on Wikipedia, which I cite as a valid to a certain degree historical source. Yeah, like it does seem to have a very strong improv base, and when you see, and there were definitely like the production that I saw was, you know, off Broadway community semi-pro theater sort of thing. And yeah, there were definitely elements in there. I was like knowing, just like having the basic knowledge of when the show came out, there were like contemporary like references to like, I think like, oh, like the landscape of the world at the time. I can't remember specific examples because I saw the show like 2 to 3 years ago. But I do remember thinking like, oh, is this... Oh, I didn't realize like this was as unscripted, because I'm like, there's no way this would be in the book itself. And it made me wonder like how much like the character relationships and interactions are, what has changed. Like I didn't realize Rona Lisa Peretti and is it Vice Principal Ponch or Doug Ponch? Like I thought the romance thing was like put in between the actors. But I'm like, no, that's actually in the book. So I love that it has that very sort of blurred landscape where you're never quite sure, you know, what is organic character work between the cast and, you know, what is strictly in the book as it, you know, existed at the time. Which is great, which is like it's honest in live theater. You know what I mean? It makes it a more organic feeling and a more playful, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I think that it gives the actors and the directors on the specific production a lot of room of where to go with characters. Like, I think that...
Totally.
Like, obviously, their sort of basic character is defined by the book and by previous productions, but there's so much space in there to take it in different directions in those improv spots and in those comedic choices between characters. Sort of main element of... weird comedy that goes on in Spelling Bee is their pattern of bringing audience members onto the stage as spellers.
Oh, yes.
When I learned that, that's like the essential part of Spelling Bee almost, and I somehow missed that completely. But when I learned it, I was like, this is the most brilliant idea I've ever heard. And so they pre-screen people, but they have them come on stage and they literally compete in the spelling bee, usually getting super easy words when they're supposed to go on and getting super hard words when they're supposed to be taken off.
Yeah.
But which is
brilliant.
Oh my God. I want to know who thought of that and were like, you know what would be a great idea if we depended our show on random audience members?
Oh, absolutely. There was the production I saw, they at one point the guy got a word, who was like the second to be eliminated, and I think they get the they're the one who gets the goodbye song. Mm-hmm. Or it's either the Comfort Counselor song or like the first goodbye, or it might be both of them. One of them got the word right that they thought they were going to get him out on, and so the guy who was hosting had to call him back. He was like, oh, that is correct, and like called, it was like so-and-so, and he like had to immediately turn back around. And so it was very clear that they were like, oh, you were supposed to, you know, get out so that we could continue the show, because like you don't want to leave the people, like the non-actors, like sitting on stage awkwardly through like the entire first act. Mm-hmm. So they just like kept going until they finally got this guy out, I think on the second or third try. And I remember thinking like, oh man, but I mean, it's impressive. And like, I, as an audience member, I'm like, that would just trigger my anxiety so much. I'd be like, what if I like get a word that I absolutely know, and like, you know, just performance anxiety and just like, whoop, like in front of this crowd of people, which is like why I'm very glad I'm not called on. I was not called on for this, but it was like incredible to watch, and it's like really fascinating to like just see random like guy or person in the audience just pulled up and just like know this deep cut word that like you never hear in day-to-day conversation. It's just like, oh, well, okay then, you know, sort of thing. And it's such a fun moment. I think it gives, you know, it builds in additional comedic moments into the show, to your point.
I find it really stressful to watch shows when there's like an audience component or like these kind of, well, I mean, I guess especially audience components, because I'm like, what if it goes wrong? And what if they don't do the right thing? Especially, I also read that like the audience members should like participate in some of the movement and the cast members just be like, move slowly right now. Or so like,
oh like yeah.
And I'm like, how do they do that? But on the other hand, I also think that the times I have laughed hardest in my life at shows have been when there is sort of a weird thing that happens with an audience member or an improv mm-hmm. aspect, and the actors are just so good at what they're doing that they're able to yeah. turn that into something really funny. And like, I think that's where the best, like some of the best things I've ever seen on stage have come from, are the things that usually make me anxious.
Oh yeah. I 100% agree. I was reading some of the history of the show, and they were like, apparently they got like the 2006 spelling champ out. Like, they invited, and I'm like, you knew this was going to go on forever. But that's such, like, a wonderful, like, what a strange but wonderful, like, meta experience to have an actual speller, like, in the audience. And obviously, like, they picked extremely hard words that they would not give anyone who wasn't, like, not planted, like, with this person in mind. And apparently it took them, like, 10-plus rounds to, like, get this person out. And I was like, that is an impressive, I don't know, feet, you know what I mean? And to your point, it was like, oh, it is something that's kind of going wrong, but kind of going right in the best way.
That I read something about that as well. And I think that's so great, because it's like with her, it's like they knew it was going to be a bunch of rounds, and they're like, this is too good not to do. We don't care how many times you have to spin around and do it again. And I kind of wish that I could be one of the spellers for Spelling Bee, even though I would also be stressed that I would spell cow wrong or something and then be off at the wrong time. When I was in elementary school, our school had a spelling bee, and I was a know-it-all, so I really wanted to participate, but then I was too young to do it. This is a weird childhood story, but I just remembered this. Okay, so we had multi-grade classrooms, and I was the youngest, and I was in like the lowest grade of the multi-grade classroom. And so I was actually too young to participate in the regional spelling bee. But we did one in the classroom to figure out who we would send to the regional spelling bee. And I won. And I was furious that I was too young to go. And then the next year they stopped doing it. So I never ever actually competed in spelling bee.
Oh my God.
So this is my chance. I got to redo it.
Yeah, there you go. You have to get in the show. You have to find a production of this show.
Of course. Oh, the other just funny thing about the spelling bee aspect of it that I think that goes underappreciated is a specific choice to have this be a county spelling bee.
Yes.
It's like enough that you can get why students and parents would be really into it, because it's like regional, but also means nothing effectively.
Oh yeah, it's like the stakes are so high for these kids, but also so low in the grand scheme of like life, you know what I mean? It's so, but I mean, like, that's, I thought that I 100% agree, because it's like, particularly like you think of Logan Schwartz and Grubier's dad, I can't pronounce that last name, Logan's dads are so like intense, high pressure. Like, they have the line, it's like, we hate losers, God hates losers, but you're not a loser because you know how to win. And it's like, and I'm like, this is a small like towns like spell, and like but the prospect is like, yeah, we get to go to DC and like, you know, compete in like a bigger B, presumably. But it's so perfect because it's like to these like 12-year-old kids, like the stakes are like everything. And I'm like, that's such a perfect encapsulation of like that time where you're like really excited about something that like, as an adult, you'd be like, okay, I guess. You know what I mean? It's like that joy and that intensity where everything is the end of the world, or like the beginning of like a new world, when it's not, when you haven't quite figured it out. It's like, yeah, life just goes on. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, I feel like God, like such a world-weary 27-year-old. When I say it, like, life goes on, kid. But no, I think you're absolutely right. That is the truth of it is like the seriousness with which like Marcy Park like has a conversation with Jesus, being like, is it okay if I throw this spelling bee? And he's like, and the line is sadly not on the soundtrack, but this is like one of my favorite like moments in the show, where like Jesus comes out, the actor who plays Chip, the production I saw, he came out on like rollerblades and was like all over the place. He had like the long wig and like a robe and was like not able to stand up on these rollerblades. And I'm like, in this like child's mind's eye, like Jesus on rollerblades, I'm like, excellent. And she's like, Jesus, this is okay if I like throw this spelling bee? And he's like, Marcy, quite frankly, this is not the thing I normally care a lot about, so go for it. And he like skates off stage. And and then she's like sits there and she like does her word, and then she like gets halfway through and then just goes X, Y, did and just starts saying like random letters that are so obviously not it. And she just takes such like a delight in like throwing the spelling bee. And then in my production, she like the comfort counselor comes to like guide her off stage. She like, jumps into his arms and is like basically like, waves like an audio suckers sort of thing. And I'm just like, what an amazing moment of just like someone. It's kind of like the antithesis to Logan sort of moment of just being devastated in the woe is me reprise of being like, I guess you can't love me, America, because like I lost. Because like I overcomplicated and I, you know, did too much. And I'm just like, it's such an interesting sort of, I don't know, like a dichotomy between those two characters, but also just like, you know, the way you handle parental pressure at that age. For something that, again, you know, odds are you're not going all the way to the top of the national spelling. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's like, we're, statistically, you're not like likely to make it all the way through this thing. But like, you know, the optimism is there, but also the pressure is there.
Yeah. And on the other hand, with that, there's sort of this very funny figure of Rona Lisa, because her whole thing is that she won the spelling bee, the third annual, and she still clearly cares about it. She's very like pageant mom-esque a little
for bit. For 22 years, yes. It's the 25th annual. I was like, for 22 years, this woman has fixated on this county spelling bee.
You know what? Sometimes your glory days come very early.
Oh, that's so dark, though. Not at 12. Oh, God.
Hey, she's a very successful realtor. She's fine.
She is. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But it's, like, wonderful that, and the fact of my favorite moment of the bee, she has 3 to 4 reprises of that song. And it's just, like, you know, like a sports nerd or, you know, any sort of, like, competition junkie who's like, oh, this is my favorite part. Oh, this is my favorite part also. Oh, this is, like, for different reasons. And, like, oh, the drama, the excitement. I just finished binging, like, the show Grace and Frankie. And Lily Tomlin's character, Frankie, she and her husband, her, like, ex-husband used to watch The Spelling Bee. And were just so into it. And they're like, ah, oh, this kid. Like, it's this sort of, like, it's like, I compare it now to, like, watching Bake Off. It's, like, the thing that you, for me personally, it's, like, a thing that I cannot do. I cannot bake. I cannot do this, like, AP spelling type stuff. And you just, like, sit there. You feel like you become an expert and you're so critical. It's, like, ah, classic error. Or, like, what a dumb mistake. You know, you took your thing out of the proving oven. Or, like, oh, man, there's clearly no H there. What are you doing? You know, to these people who have like dedicated their lives to this thing, you know, just as a layperson, you know what I mean? But yeah. Rona Lisa very much has that sort of still in the biz, or like, you know, like someone who's like a child actor who like still remembers all their lines from the production of Oliver that they were in when they were like 12. You know what I mean? It's just like something that's so real and true. Like, you're right, like a pageant mom who did pageants, who like got like somewhat far, but not enough for it to really matter. But her earnestness and commitment to it kind of redeems it a little. You know, where she's not, like, hard on the kids at all, but she's, like, very sympathetic and just, like, cheering kind of for all of them.
Yeah. I think she is, like if you're going to be still into the thing you did when you were 12, this is really the right way to do it, because she really is, like, she's so excited about everything. She's loves these kids and she wants them to do well and is so happy every time one of them does well. Although she's also happy when they get eliminated for the drama of it. But, you know, it's a County Spelling Bee. It's fine.
Absolutely. And it's like, these kids will recover, you know?
Yeah. This will make them stronger in the end. You know, you need a little bit of struggle in your life.
Oh, absolutely. And a thing I do like about the show, I wish this was on the album or, like, better explained in the Wikipedia. Like, at the end of the show, they all kind of tell you how they, like, turned out in life. And spoiler alert, Olive, who does not win, who comes in second in the B, was like, hers is the only backstory that I remember. Like, she ultimately becomes... Like, she competes, like, the next year and does, like, pretty okay and then, like, grows up in life to become, like, some sort of, like, morning radio host or something, like, a very, like, benevolent sort of, like, radio host profession. And every year she hosts the runner-up to the 25th annual Putnam – or the annual Putnam County Spelling Bee comes on her show. And I'm like, that is so pure. and it's something, like – Yeah, these characters in their, like, sort of final, like, and this character did this, you know, like, epilogue, they kind of, their arc is continued. Like, Marcy is, like, writes a book about, like, oh, it's okay to fail, and it does not become a bestseller. You know, is, like, the, it's, like, the follow-up line to hers. It's, like, all these characters, like, have grown for better, for the better, actually. I don't think for worse for any of them. At the end of this experience, like, it's which is, I think, a nice sort of cap on the sort of, like, overall theme and message of the show.
Yeah, I think that this show is so built just to be funny and charming, and it does that extremely well. But there's also a surprising amount of heart and character development that goes on over the course of the two acts in the B. And then I think that, like, capping it with that is really nice. I'm such a sucker for those things. Like, when TV shows end with a, like, and here's 10 years in the future and everybody's happy, I'm like, yes, that's all I want.
Yeah, for real. Like, that, and, you know, in theater, you know, I feel like not everything needs that, but for Spelling Bee, these arcs for all of these characters are so well realized. You know, even in the course of, like, a single song, you see so much, like, development and growth of these characters, which is why I think I really love it, because I really feel like you've completed a journey with each of them. And I don't know how much of these individual ones we will ultimately, or you would prefer to get into, but it's, I feel, you know, really satisfied by that. And, like, the epilogue at the end, like, kind of caps that off in a way that, like, is really sweet, but, like, you don't necessarily need it. But they give it to you, and it's like, oh, that's, like, you know, and even, you know, it is, like, the cherry on top to an already, like, very satisfying sort of, like, I don't know, you don't put a cherry on a tiramisu. But I was trying to think of something with layers, but yeah. Like a layer cake. Like a Black Forest cake.
Yeah, and it's, like, the show is not trying to be, like, some devastating commentary on the human experience or something like that. Like, it's a good time, and you grow to care about these characters as you're laughing, and so I think it's completely appropriate to end it with, like, a and here's the happy ending, you know, and it's just life, and life is cool.
Oh yeah. Life is cool. I think that's really I mean, I don't disagree with that at all. I love that. This is a soundbite. Life is cool.
Yeah, I mean, so that's the thing. It's like, it's none of them became, you know, none of them, like, won the Scripps National Spelling Bee or became super famous or whatever, but, like, you know, they had good lives.
Yeah, I think Schwartzy, Logan Schwartz and Grubiner, gets to the B the next year, because she was the youngest to compete mm-hmm. in this one. I think she makes it to the next round the following year, which is, like, kind of a very nice redemption arc, since she goes out on such a, like, sad, like, very, like, bummer note, but which is the completion of, like, what her progression would be. Organically be, if that makes sense. It's, like, kind of the only progression she could have mm-hmm. as a character. But it's nice. It's like, yeah, you know, she recovers from this loss, and, like, you know, the sort of, without her parental pressure, you know, without feeling quite so much pressure, she does better the next time, and she, like, learns and grows from this.
We kind of bounced around a couple different characters in terms of like their arcs and what they go through and whatever, but we want to stop and go a little bit more in depth. Who do you think has the kind of best arc throughout the show?
I'm not going to lie to you. I teared up a little bit in my production. And still, like, when I listen to it on Jesse Tyler Ferguson sing the song on the album, the I'm Not That Smart reprise.
Oh, yeah.
Because in the moment, because, like, his first song is called I'm Not That Smart, and he's like, my siblings
have been telling me that for years, that I'm not smart. We're schooled at home. They see who's bright. It breaks my heart. I'm not that smart.
And it's basically, like, he's from, like, a huge family of, like, hippies, but who are also, like, weirdly aggressive hippies that they're, like, putting down this, like, kid who definitely is not the brightest that we glean. And so, like, when he finally does spells all his words right in a weird trance, like, he gets distracted by his hair. And at one point in his first song, he's like, I like my hair. It's, like, pleasant to the touch. And he's flipping with his hair, and he starts prancing around the stage. He wears a cape in most productions. And so he's just, like, running, and he has a part of him like, la, 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 doo, 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 doo. And he just starts making these weird noises. And then he's, like, and they're, like, please spell the word. And he's, like, oh, what was it again? And, then, like, they tell him the word. And then he, like, is, like, oh, it's, like, a rodent, da, da, da. And he just starts going into this trance, and he goes, A, C, I don't know the actual spelling of Akuchi, but he spells it correctly, and they're like, oh my gosh, it's right. And he is like, oh, I do like spelling, which I should clarify, he only gets into the show. He only gets into the Putnam County Spelling Bee because the winner and runner-up both have to attend the winner's bar mitzvah. And so he's the third runner-up. Because everyone else had something better to do, ostensibly, and he comes in, and so his, like, family comes to, like, support him, and they're like, you know, we'll be in and out, like, in a tight, you know, 15 or whatever. And he gets pretty far, and when we get to his reprise, he, you know, spells something wrong, and he's like, oh, I hear the bell, and he's like, to me, that's not an inviting sound, and he's, like, very sad for a second, but he's like, you know what, I came away from this. And he's like, I think. And he's like, no, I know. And he's like, I'm smart. And he's like this big, like, big finish. And he holds the note. And he's like, apple juice, please. And, like, because all the losers are the comfort counselor, Mitch Mahoney, hands them an apple juice and, like, escorts them off stage. And he's like, I'll take my apple juice. And it's, like, such a beautiful, triumphant moment where this kid believes something new about himself and, like, it just becomes, like, weirdly empowered from, you know, not even winning the bee, just doing better than he thought, you know what I mean? It was, like, such a beautiful, I'm getting emotional just talking about it, like, oh my gosh, just of my opinion. I think he has the most satisfying arc. Olive and Barfay also have, like, a wonderful one together. Olive Ostrowski, who is, like, the very sweet, gentle girl who, like, comes in second, whose parents both, like, are very, like, clearly in, like, a bad relationship place. Her mom goes to an ashram, and her dad, like, is, like, supposed to come, and he just doesn't. And it becomes increasingly evident throughout the bee that, like, you know, she kind of hoped that they would both be proud of her and, like, show up, and they don't. But her and William Barfay is kind of, like, the, like, standoffish, not quite a bully, but just, like, you know, doesn't have a ton of friends. They kind of form a friendship, and he seems to get a bit of a crush on her, but they just kind of have this mutual respect for each other, that they both are, like, huge nerds and both super good at this very niche thing. Like, you get that they both clearly kind of don't have a lot of friends other than, as she sings, like, my friend the dictionary. You know, it's, like, a thing that they both have sort of clung to in their, like, sort of loneliness, I guess. And they kind of bond over that, and I always think that's a very wonderful arc that they share together.
Yeah, I think that, like, all three of those characters you just talked about, like, you see them really change over the course of the show, and especially Leaf, and he's so sweet, and I even though he's played by a grown man, it still feels very much like watching a kid sort of because you see so many kids who are convinced they're not smart and are told they're not smart, and it's heartbreaking every time. And then he's like, you know what, I can do this thing, and then I don't have to be like the biggest genius in the room or whatever to be smart and to believe in myself. And I'm like, yes, Leaf, yes. And it's just like the same kind of sense of self that you see with like Barfay and Olive, where I feel like Barfay is so obnoxious and focused on winning, and he's this little nerd, and that he's like super intense about the competition, and at the end he's willing to throw it away to let Olive win, and he ultimately doesn't, and he chooses to spell his word correctly, but he was like, wow, this is a person I care about, and maybe that is more important than the spelling bee. And I think that even that consideration in itself shows a lot of growth.
Absolutely. He's like, he makes a and he very much like gets you know, the song where he develops, like, which, like, until recently I was like, is it, I was like unclear if it was like a crush or just like a very strong, like, respecting friendship. Like, no, he definitely very much has, like, you know, preteen feelings for her. But it is, yeah, it's very sweet that he like kind of comes to the point where he's like, yeah, I would throw this away, but she. And then that same song, the I Will Not Come in Second, or it's like, is it my favorite moment reprise, and then second, she, Olive, kind of has a moment where she shows a little bit of like teeth, where she's like, I will not come in second, I'm going to win, it's going to be great. It's like, before she was just kind of in it, it's like, oh, I just like spelling, and this is just like a fun thing to do. But she's like, no, I want to win, I'm going to go to DC, you know, sort of moment. But then she sees like Barfay like kind of work through it in his mind while he's spelling the word in real time. And they have a, like an adorable like pas de deux on stage, like where it's just like a moment of like sort of like a cappella, just like do 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 do, and it's like a very long like slow dance together where it's like in his mind like deciding what he wants to do, but he does ultimately, but she's like, it's okay, win, you know. And he's like, okay, I will win and be satisfied in it, but you know, he was willing to throw it. And also, like, even Doug Ponch, who, like, while Olive is supposed to have like a $25 entrance fee, and she didn't know that, and her dad, who was supposed to be there, was supposed to, like, hey, she's like, oh, my dad will bring it when he comes, but he, like, ultimately, spoiler alert, never shows up. The, you know, the moderator ultimately, like, is like, oh, the second place prize is $25, and so she's like, oh, okay, cool, and then, like, here's my entrance fee, you know, at the, like, she's just such a sweet sort of person. Mm-hmm. Just sort of despite, you know, the things that are going on in her family life, between her parents, who are very like in a very like bad, very bad place. It's very, it's interesting that like her sweetness is like not uncomplicated, but it's there, but it's also, she's not like a weak character by any extent of the imagination. She's not, she's meek with a sort of like a strength and a drive to her, which is really great to see.
Yeah, and I mean, she's also like 12, and so that's that. I feel like that's an arc that many of us can identify with, is being very meek at 12 and then growing from, yeah, that, and sort of like coming to your own. And then this came up at the very beginning of the episode, but we got, you know, pour one out for Chip.
Chip!
It's so funny.
Oh, that was, this was the song that sold me on the show. Because before I was like, oh, there's like pleasant enough songs. I wasn't. And like, I hadn't read the full summary when I first listened to it. Because like, I got halfway through and they're like, I was in the part of the Wikipedia where they're like setting up all the characters. And I was like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. Okay, I'll just listen to it. And then I got to this song. Yeah, Chip Tolentino, who was the previous champion, notices Leaf Coney Bear's sister Marigold from across the, I don't know, cafetorium or whatever that they're in. you know, gets his an unfortunate erection.
Erection! Erection! My unfortunate erection!
This song was the first thing I ever knew about this musical.
Oh, excellent.
Sort of a backwards way to you, because I just remember this from years and years ago, We used to listen to the SiriusXM show tune station in the car because I come from a family of Broadway nerds. And then My Unfortunate Erection was playing, and my mom was like, how would you like to be on Broadway and, like, your big solo is about an erection?
Right?
What a mixed bag.
Like, Jose Lana, who's had, like, an amazing career and continues to have an amazing career, I'm like, how he did not, you know, not to take anything away from Dan Fogler's Tony, you know, who was the only actor to win a Tony from this show, the, you know, that year. I was like, how did Jose Lana not also get a Tony for this? Because I'm like, to that level of, vulnerability, but I was like, teen angst to tap into 8 times a week. It's just amazing. And it's like a big belty thing. It's a big belty piece. But it's truly like a humbling arc for this character. And especially since they make... that song leads into the intermission. And so it's like, they're like, the first one eliminated has to help sell snacks, which I'm like, first of all, this would be a terrible practice if this was done anywhere in real life. Because I'm like, what a blow to someone's self-esteem to not only be the first one out, but to also have to, like, serve their peers snacks.
Yeah, now you're in the service industry. Good luck.
Yeah, yeah, you've been radically demoted. And so it's like, and it's like so much like teen shame, but like, you know, as someone who did not happen, it's relatable in the way that, like, oh, this biological hormonal teen thing, you know, that I do not control, being embarrassed by, you know, the closest thing I could possibly relate it to is like getting your period and it, like, you know, and it like showing in some kind of way, you know what I mean? Or like a tampon or something falling out of your purse, you know what I mean? Where it's a thing that, like, everyone has, everyone deals with, but at that age, it's like the life or death stakes, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's like, does it actually matter? No. But does it matter more than anything in the entire universe at that moment?
Yes. Absolutely. Yes. But it's, yeah. And it's like a thing that's like cringy funny. Shout out to Jose Lana for such an incredible performance of that song and just, it's so great. I want to talk about it more, but I know you're lightning round, and so I feel like I'll talk about it a bit more there too.
Okay, good. We can save a little bit for the lightning round. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's it. Like I said, that was the first song I ever knew from this. So I actually thought this show was a lot more adult than it is.
Raunchier, yeah.
It turns out they used to do like raunchy productions of it where like special like adults only productions, which I think is hysterical, and I would love to witness this. Yeah, but for the most part, it was like it's like PG-13. It's not super out there or anything.
It's exactly PG-13 in the sense that I'm like, I would take 12 and 13 year olds very specifically to see this, which is like, because there is a fair amount of like sexual innuendo and stuff like that, but nothing. It's not like an upsetting level. When I saw Avenue Q on Sunday, I sat behind an 8-year-old.
Oh, no.
Directly behind an 8-year-old between his two parents. And I was like, why would you do this?
There are signs everywhere that say this is not for children.
This is not. He's like, and I was like, and they got to a moment of a puppet intercourse. And I was like, please take this child from this. It just made me, as an audience member, I was like, oh, man, you guys are like the chillest parents on earth. almost to the point where I'm like, maybe you shouldn't. There is a song called Everyone's a Little Bit Racist and the Internet is for Porn. Why?
That song is so funny.
Yeah. Oh, I was led to late last night being on the internet to the school version of Avenue Q, which there is an MTI has a school version when they changed the lyrics to The Internet is for Porn is the internet. No, the internet is for friends.
What?
And it's basically about Kate Monster's like, I'm going to teach a thing about a class about friendship. Wait,
I found a recording. My social life is online.
Yeah, my social life is like, and it goes online. And I'm like, what are you doing? And basically the end of the song, Kate Monster signs up for Facebook.
That's,
or like, they don't name Facebook by name. But, and I was like, why? First of all, why would a school ever do a production of Avenue Q? But I digress. But yeah, I'd be very curious to see a After Dark. The production that I saw was put on by like people in their, you know, 20s to 30s plus. So, you know, it leaned a little into the stuff, but it wasn't, I did not feel it was very an After Dark, quote unquote, production. I think they call it the parent teacher conference or something like that production. So I'd be very curious to see like how much more into that they lean into, with like the other words of the show.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that the improv becomes very explicit, if they're allowed to let loose with that.
Oh, totally.
One other thing that I wanted to mention, because I feel like we have to at least touch on this, is that when they performed this at the Tonys, they had Al Sharpton come out and be the guest speller.
Yes!
What? Why?
Which, because I think just because he was, they knew he was going to be there, I imagine. And so they were like, will you do it? And he yes-anded them in the best way. Which is amazing. Apparently, they also did it, not there, but at some performance with Julie Andrews, and they gave her supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. And naturally, she was like, man, I'm 60 plus. Leave me. Like, of course I don't remember how to spell that. Which I don't think they make you spell it in the song either. I think in the Broadway show they might spell it, but not in original musical. So they got her out on that, but I'm like, man, could you imagine inviting Al Sharpton on the... You're already performing at the Tonys, and this was, like, 7 of the 9 cast members. That was their Broadway debut. So could you imagine on your Broadway debut going to the Tonys and then also interacting with Al Sharpton on stage?
Oh my gosh. I looked up the video because, of course, I had to see this. And they give a fun fact for every contestant, including the audience contestants. So when Al Sharpton walked up, they were like, Al is running for class president next year on the platform of racial equality and macaroni and cheese.
Yes! Oh, that's so good. I need to watch this. It's absolutely cute. That sounds so pure.
I find this cast so adorable as well because it was the entire off-Broadway cast moved to the on-Broadway production, which is pretty rare. This is like a quite small cast. And then they as well like have sort of these comedy backgrounds. And Jesse Tyler Ferguson was in the original cast, which you already mentioned, and he's gone on to success on TV as well as on theater. And he's also just...
Yeah, he has a drama desk.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, he's... And he's so adorable. I think he's just so cute every time he does anything, especially when he's playing a 12-year-old and he's trying to be adorable.
Yeah. I saw him. He did Shakespeare in the Park 3 or 4 years back in The Tempest, and he was like Trinculo or something. He was like a supporting character, and he was like great in it. And I'm like, he is someone who seems to genuinely have a love of theater, even though he is out there, you know, making, you know, big bucks on Modern Family. You know, out in LA a lot of the time, like, he very much comes back to New York every, like, 2 or 3 years and will do theater of some sort.
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
My very niche Jesse Tyler Ferguson recommendation is there's a show called The Class, which it was around for 1 season. There were, like, 12 episodes ever. It was ended on a cliffhanger and was canceled, which is so sad. But has a bunch of people in it, including Jesse Tyler Ferguson. And it's so funny. I don't even know if you can get it, but because it was not successful. But my parents happened to see it at the time and loved it, so they have it on DVD, and I watched it a few years ago. And if anyone else knows about The Class, tweet at me, because it is extremely funny.
I need to find this. Yeah, so it was on CBS in 2006. Oh, wow. This is a deep cut.
This is the most deep cut TV show I have.
You can get it from YouTube and Amazon for $2.
Okay, nice. There you go. I was also just looking at the cast replacements, and so they always include like notable cast replacements. And they mentioned that Josh Gad played Barfay at some point, and I'm like, that tracks.
Could you think of more perfect casting for that part?
I literally couldn't. I thought it was Josh Gad for a second when I first saw him.
Yeah. And then they had, in a West Coast production, he didn't do it on Broadway, but James Monroe Inglehart, who famously won a Tony for playing Genie in Aladdin, like, 3 or 4 years ago,
yeah.
As Mitch Mahoney, the comfort counselor. And I'm like, I would love to see him in that part. He's currently on Broadway in Hamilton, I suppose, would be the most recent thing that he's done. But I'm like, I would love to see him in this part.
I know. He's so funny, and he has so much energy. He's so great. This is always a segment of the show as we just evolve to talking about Broadway actors and how great they are, but it's true.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's so great. And also, a thing that, like, when I was, like, doing research on some of the cast members, what is her name who played Marcy Park?
Deborah Craig.
Deborah Craig, yes. I went on her, like, website. I was like, oh, what has she been up to? Because, like, Marcy, spoiler alert for, like, Lightning Round, is, like, I think my favorite character and who I'd want to play. Just because I love I Speak Six Languages. And she just seems, like, it's a fun character. This is the first, apparently, like, explicitly stated, like, canonically Korean-American character on Broadway.
Wow.
Yeah. Because, like, normally, because I was, like, thinking about it, and I was like, yeah, like, where there would have been Asian characters in the past, they're explicitly either something else, or they're just, like, either played by an Asian actor, but it was, like, the role was either written for someone who was, like, white, or, like, you know, their race isn't particularly specified. Or it's, like, explicitly, like, another type of, like, Asian or Asian American. And I was like, wow, this is the only Korean, or the first Korean character that I can think. Maybe since then there have been, like, plays or something with a Korean, Korean or Korean American cast. But I was just like, wow. But also I'm like, wow, it took until, like, 2004, 2005 for that to happen. But yeah, but I'm like, wow, imagine being the first to explicitly play someone of your, you know, cultural group on Broadway. And, like, especially it's such a great part, which, like, I'm sure, you know, we can talk about later in terms of, like, some of the, you know, a few of the stereotypes that the show, like, kind of plays into, for which would have been, like, thinking of, like, the way the early 2000s were, would have been, like, not great, but, like, less problematic than it is now. But, you know, like, Marcy and Mitch Mahoney are, like, the only two characters where I'm like, you know, depending on how this is done now, you know, you can sidestep some of it, but, you know, at the time it would have been like, oh, cool, a part explicitly for a black actor and for a Korean or Korean American actress, you know.
Yeah, that was something I didn't pick up on just listening to it, and then you go and watch Coast Summit and you're like, oh. Yeah, because it's like Marcy is your super overachiever, and she's Korean, and then Mitch Mahoney.
She's a true model minority.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that the description for casting it is, like, she's the model minority.
Oh, is,
like,
it?
Asian. In certain things I've read, I was like, oh, that's great. Or the overachieving Asian.
Yeah. And then the character Mitch Mahoney is the comfort counselor, but he's explicitly there doing, like, community service from being arrested, and he's the only black character,
right? It's like, in the show is, like, fine, and that most of the other characters, you know, are not explicitly one race or another, with the exception of, like, Marcy. And even Marcy, like, the production I saw, the majority of the cast was white, and the Mitch Mahoney in this production was white, and which, like, somehow, like, just because, like, it was, like, a community group, and they just didn't have, you know, I don't think they had too many people of color audition necessarily, you know, who would have been, like, the range and stuff, and vocal range and stuff for the part. So I'm like, somehow this kind of makes this a little less problematic, because they kind of had it, like, very much like a white gangster type. And I'm like, I'm kind of more okay with this. Then, you know, if the low, but I was like, but it being written explicitly into the show was, you know, as being very much a black actor, I was kind of like, as much as I do like, you know, as, you know, a black woman, I'm like, yeah, you know, black actors getting checks. Awesome. But the actor who originated the role on Broadway, Derek Baskin, is, if you ever see the show Difficult People, with Julie Klausner and Billy Eichner and Gabby Sidibe, he's absolutely fantastic in it. He has an episode where he's childhood rivals with Lin-Manuel Miranda. And he's like, stole the idea from Hamilton from my, like, fourth grade paper where I rapped about the, like, founding fathers. I definitely recommend the show if you've never seen it. But he's, like, a fantastic actor in that, and he sounds fantastic on the recording. So, like, he definitely is someone who I was like, you know what? If Derek Baskin, you know, is doing this, like, I would enjoy seeing him do this part, you know, but it's something that in this day and age, like, you can cast around it, which I was like, is it better for it to be whitewashed, or is it better for it to just be an actor of another race, but or to just have another, you know, black actor, actor of color to, like, sort of offset, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. What would feel like a stereotype. Same with Marcy. It was like, you know, Jose Lana is, like, Filipino, American, and, you know, Deborah S. Craig was Korean American. So I'm like, so it's like, okay, not the only Asian in, it's not one Asian person in the show is the model minority, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? But it's still, you know, it's still a thing where it's like, this character was written as a type, you know, and obviously productions, you know, have the freedom to cast in a way that mitigates things of that nature. But it's one of the few things in the show that I feel like don't hold up. Whereas, like, Logan having two dads is, like, a fantastic, you know, inclusion and character development that was, like, a little ahead of its time, or either on par with the times, I think, or, like, a little ahead.
Yeah, I think, and the whole idea of, like, these two characters being stereotypes, and I think they were, like, set up like that on purpose as sort of this, I think it was supposed to be, like, poking fun at this, like, idea of, like, suburban white neighborhood where everybody really cares about the spelling bee and that kind of thing, but it's also, like, right. It's a pretty lazy joke.
Yeah, and the characters both do get complicated.
Yeah.
In certain ways, which is great, which is nice, but it's, like, starting from a place that it didn't necessarily have to be, you know what I mean?
I think it's definitely not, it's not, like, irredeemable.
Yes, yeah.
But it definitely, it starts from a place of, like, a joke based on a stereotype, and those characters are still, like, have great songs and, like, are interesting characters on their own feet and whatever. That's not the phrase, but whatever, I lost the idiom.
Yeah, no.
And I think that the casting decisions that are made in each production, like, there's nothing that says the other characters are, like, explicitly white, and that you can cast this however you want to, and so there's a lot of space in that to sort of make decisions production by production.
Exactly. It's like Marcy Park. Like, Park is very much a Korean last name, but it also is, you know, an English word. So, like, theoretically, she could be of any race. Mitch Mahoney could be of any race, depending on, like, how you cast it. I entirely agree. And it is a thing that I'm looking at, having seen the show in the 2010s versus seeing it in 2005. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something at that time I, you know... Also, I would have been a lot younger, so I don't think I would have necessarily been aware of the, you know what I mean? Of the nuances of, you know, stereotypes in quite the same way as an adult. So I'm like, not to give something entirely a pass on it being a product of the past, but it's like there are ways to, yeah, to your point, it's like it's not an entirely irredeemable thing. It's not like a very, you know, upsetting or problematic, like, which is why it's like not... to go back to constantly be talking about Avenue Q in this podcast. When I saw her, I was very nervous about Christmas Eve when I went to see her. The actress who did her was stellar and, like, amazing voice, and gave this character humor and, like, the level of, you know, not making the accent 100% the butt of the joke, which is what she's so much... It feels like she... As much as I love Anne Harada, and she is amazing and a gift... She, you know what I mean? It's like, and having not been able to have seen Anne Harada's performance because I was, like, 12 and lived in Virginia at the time, and my parents absolutely would not have taken me to a show that has a song "The Internet is for Porn," you know, which makes me curious about how, you know, actors of this particular demographic who find themselves in these parts, what their way in is. You know, obviously, I'm not the right person to talk about that as someone who is not an actor or of that group in particular, but I'm sure there are ways, you know, if you are a strong actor who can build, empathy and timing and, you know, find the nuances in this character. There are ways of doing it so it feels less stereotypical or, you know, to you or to people of your community.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, and making those characters your own. And I think that it, in this show, there's a lot to work with there. And a lot of space, like we were talking about earlier, like a lot of space for comedy, but also just a lot of space to take the characters in different directions.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Which, you know, is great, which is neat of a show that's as improv-based as it is. I think it lends itself to that way better than many other shows.
Amazing. So we're getting close to the end of time. So I think we should head over to the lightning round.
Yay! Oh, I'm excited. I looked at these questions. I'm like, these are fantastic questions. I'm like, but I feel like I need to study and prepare for these because I'm like, there's so many good things.
Well, we've touched on a few of these already, but this is a chance to sort of run through them. So we'll start off with, what is your favorite song?
Yeah, I speak six languages, which I looked up the other day the lyrics to, and I was like, oh, the part where she actually is speaking the six languages. She actually speaks seven in it. And I was like, oh, I didn't know what she was saying in those parts. And apparently it's the verses of the chorus, each in the first line is in French and then Spanish, Japanese, Russian, Hebrew, and then the final one's like, and like it's like, I can say hello is the sixth language. And then in at least seven more she says in German. Oh my god, I love this. It's such a great, I don't know, it's just like a very fun song. It has a great, like, the female ensemble in it has like very fun, it's like a very fun sort of like chorus, but just her Deborah Craig's interpretation of it is so fun. She's like, as my life unscrolls, like, I'm just so, like, bored, and I'm perfect. Like, I'm bored with, like, being so perfect. But I do, like, in the book of the show, they do clarify that, like, it does kind of come at a cost, where she's like, I sleep, like, 4 hours a night, I hide in the cupboard, and I do all these things. But it's, like, which, like, you know, not, and, like, some of that, you know, you get the feeling is very much, like, parentally encouraged, but then you also get the sense that, like, this has also become her, and she talks about, like, winning is a job, I get no real enjoyment, where she's like, yeah, I've gotten so used to this, you know, it doesn't feel traumatic to lose, because she doesn't, you know what I mean, like, she's just become so good at this. And her arc of just being like, oh, I don't have to be, I can do whatever I want, really, you know, it is a very fun sort of, which she comes to, like, after this song. It's just a very fun song to sing along to, and I love the rest of the Spellers, the ensemble, when they come in and then sing with her in all the different, in the seven languages.
Simultaneously, like, a beautiful piece of character and tells you so much in so little time, but also just, it's such a fun song. And then you can, you know, learn a little bit of all these different languages. So that's plus for you too.
Yeah.
Now, what is your favorite line from the show?
I know. Well, I've already talked about this so much. And if my parents are listening, I am sorry for what you're going to have to hear, but it's erection. It's just him shouting erection. Like, five, it's like, erection, erection, my unfortunate erection. Like, just that part over. It's just, like, that was the point. I can't remember if I was, like, at my desk. I used to be an assistant at, like, a job that I, like, hated at the time. And I was listening to it during the workday. I was like, okay, I should, like, study up on this. I got to that part. I think I was in tears at my desk because I was just not prepared. That was the point, like, just, oh, I'd never heard a show tune, even as familiar as I was with Avenue Q, just someone, like, shouting about an erection in an agonized voice, is the most teen boy thing ever. But also, I have to say, this is gonna make me sound like a monster, because, like, I recognize very sadistic moments, the part, they're the like dark parts of the goodbye song is like, you were good but not good enough, like that stuff, where they just like the sweet little like, oh, goodbye. like and what was the other one where the Logan's two dads was like, we hate losers.
No one likes a loser. Which is why we discipline. God hates losers.
But he loves you.
Because losers do not know how to.
And I'm like, it's just such a dark and horrible thing to say to anyone, but particularly like an impressionable child. Mm-hmm. It's like, but we love you, honey, because you know how to win. It's just the moments, I think, of the show that are just kind of like, unexpected. Like all three of those moments are like unexpected and like sharp feeling, I suppose, and then otherwise very like warm. They're sharply funny, in ways that I think about how I felt the first time I listened to it, but also just listening to it and knowing these songs as well as I do, just they get me every time. Oh god, I'm tempted to tell you to cut this, but I'm like, no, I'm speaking my truth.
No, I think those are all such beautiful moments.
Justice for Chip Tolentino.
Now, who's your favorite character?
My favorite character arc is, as I said, Leaf Coney Bears. But Marcy, I think, is so... I don't know. I feel like she has, like, a very fun sort of storyline.
And is she who you would want to play in a production of this?
I would love to play Marcy Park. But yeah, another character that I think we didn't talk much about, apart from like the sort of stereotypes in it, and Mitch Mahoney's like comforting nature, you know, seeing him as this caretaker who ultimately does like lean into being a very sweet caretaker to these kids.
Yeah,
is great. He also the prayer of the comfort counselor is a fantastic song.
Oh my god, yes.
You can go with pride. You've been the best looking dude.
And the harmonies in it is a very big like gospel energy to it. And it's like, you know, he's like, I think this is the one that is sung to an audience member, because it's like, you're the best looking dude we've had all day. And it's a very sweet, you know, he like puts his arm around him and is like, then hands, I think they give this actor, or they give this person a juice box and stuff as well, like they do with the other characters. It's very funny. But it's such a like a big show-stopping number, that it's a very good song, and like his arc becomes very interesting. It's like, you know, the like gruff guy's like, man, I just care about these kids.
He's got layers.
Oh, he has so many layers.
Who would you recommend go see this show?
Not to be blithe, like, everyone should see it. I genuinely think this is a show that functions, even if you're not even seeing the adult after dark Tarantino version. I think genuinely it's a show adults can watch, which, like, initially, I was initially a little off put by the name, thinking it was like a children's theater sort of thing. Not that there's anything wrong with children's, like, or shows geared towards children. I was just like, this may not be like my taste at this moment, you know, but seeing, you know, it is a show that adults can enjoy. You know, I was like, I very much assumed it was more in line with like Charlie Brown and being a very like wholesome family, you know, nothing controversial in any way, you know, type show. But I think it really is a show that functions well for adults, but particularly I really would take like any pubescent kid to, like, I really would, from like 10, anyone who's 10 years old or older, I would absolutely take them to the show. Cause it's like, even the raunchier stuff in there is like about going through puberty and about the human body. And it's like, this is not things that these kids are unfamiliar with. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. This is not dissimilar from the struggles that they're going through in their life, you know, or that they know someone who's going through, or like in terms of being like bullied and feeling like an outsider, or like, you know, having parents that don't, you know, necessarily support and understand you, or high parental expectation, you know, or the converse, or it's like extremely high parental expectation, Or like, you know, having two, you know, queer identifying parents. You know, these things are not, you know, what would have made the show, quote unquote, more adult at the time it came out or marketed towards adults, I don't think should not be considered, would not, I think on the whole, be considered a barrier today, if that makes sense. I feel like this is a show that should be, you know, kids of that age group would be a little scandalized by, like, seeing something like having, you know, erections talked about on stage. They're like, whoa, what? You know, but, you know, especially if, you know, they are not, we're not 8 years old seeing Avenue Q. They would be, I don't know, feel represented in a way that I feel like could be meaningful and that they would enjoy without feeling preached to or pandered to, if that makes sense.
Yeah, those are some really good observations with that and that how adult this show actually is relative to that. And then my final question is, if you could combine this show with another one, which one would you pick?
Again, I'm going to say Avenue Q, because, like, I just think with puppets, could you imagine just adding puppet characters? It would just be, like, a whole mess. I think it would be as funny, both these shows, you know, as I've talked about a million times before, I'm so sorry, both coming-of-age narratives, you know, a lot of the themes are not quite the same, but, like, a line. It's about finding yourself and finding what you're good at and understanding who you are, but having fun and making, you know, a mixed bag of good and bad decisions along the way. I think people who like one show would like the other, and so I think these shows would blend quite well into each other.
Amazing. And that brings us to the end. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me. This was super fun.
And thank you all for listening.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Corner of the Sky. As I said in the beginning, this is membership season at the Incomparable Network, so a ton of shows are recording bonus episodes just for members. When Carrie and I recorded this episode, we actually got stuck on a 10-minute tangent about inappropriate musicals adapted for high schools, and most of that got cut, but we love that topic so much that we recorded an entire episode where we planned out our own high school theater seasons just full of adapted adult shows. It was so much fun, and you can listen to it by becoming a member of The Incomparable for as little as $5 a month. By becoming a member, you also get access to all of those other bonus episodes from other shows, all of them that have ever been recorded, not just from this season. You also get bootleg episodes of certain shows right after they've been recorded. Not this one, sorry, but, you know, other shows on the network. And you also get a members community on Slack. You can get bonus gifts like t-shirts if you want to support at higher levels, or if you prefer, you can choose the annual equivalent of any of those monthly membership levels. If you're interested in getting tons of cool bonus stuff and supporting this show, you can go to theincomparable.com/members. And if you're not able to financially support the show right now, why not support it by writing a review in Apple Podcasts? No matter what you're able to do, thank you so much for listening, and see you next week.